I'm just super excited that we're seeing different types of representation across TV, film, and music, where you're seeing Asian and Asian American voices all having success. The volume and the magnitude of the success means that it really crossed over more into the mainstream. This is now all part of American culture. And that, to me, has been the goal and the hope when I set out about 5-6 years ago. And I know other folks in our space as well, a lot of us built around the same time. Jing from Fly By Jing, the Kevins from Emmy. We all had this idea that we're not trying to just build in our own little Asian corner. Our brands are actually part of a bigger American trend.
Welcome to the Consumer Rundown Podcast, your destination for the people, companies, and trends transforming today's consumer markets. We are your hosts. I'm Penny.
And I'm Dimitri.
Today, we're chatting with Sandro, the founder of Sanzo, the sparkling water brand that's bringing unique Asian flavors to the masses. We discuss what inspired Sandro to launch Sanzo, the challenges of building as a first-time founder within CPG, and how Sandro stays true to the brand's vision.
Sandro, thank you so much for joining us today. We're super excited to have you and get into your story. You and Sanzo has such a great origin story, but just for those who may be listening who aren't familiar, could you please give us a quick recap of how the idea was born and how you decided to take this leap?
Of course. And yeah, first off, again, thank you so much for having me and wanting to share our story. I often describe Sanzo as a manifestation of a personal journey that I was on in mid-2010s. I had the idea for the company in 2018. And what I was seeing in the world was the massive influx of interest in Asian and Asian American creators, voices, flavors, but specifically in the world of TV, film, and music. It was a banner year for our community with a film like Crazy Rich Asians becoming the number one film at the box office. Within the world of K-pop, BTS is on their first nationwide tour and literally selling out football stadiums. The magnitude of the success showed that it was actually crossing over in a much bigger way, even beyond API. And I was like, wow, like that's just super cool. I'm Filipino-American. I was born in Queens, raised in Jersey. I can't say I was necessarily like othered or exoticized as a kid, but was never like the most outwardly prideful about my culture until around that time when it was like, oh my gosh, like all these people that look like me are having big mainstream success in broader American culture. And that was definitely like the most formative part of the experience. And then also specifically related to CPG, 2018 was also, at least for me, my summer that I fell in love with sparkling water. That's when I first started drinking brands like LaCroix, discovered Spindrift, which was starting to take off at that time. And I particularly loved it because I was looking for something that was a little bit more flavorful than water. I had been going through a bit of a health and wellness journey where I was learning really about the perils of sugar. For me, what I also noticed was, hey, a lot of these brands were covering mostly the same flavors, your lemons, your limes, your grapefruit, some kind of mixed berry. And I just felt like with the changing world that I'm seeing, these big cultural experiences, there's an opportunity to contribute to this conversation by utilizing Asian fruit flavors that for me, just I hadn't seen on broader American grocery shelves. It would only be in H Mart, 99 Ranches. You would see these kinds of flavors there. But I thought, hey, here's a way that we could bridge cultures through a very delicious, light and refreshing medium through water.
Yeah, I love that. And as an Asian person, I've been, similar to you, so excited just to see the representation our community has gotten just in media. Netflix, every few months, coming out with content that has Asian cast, Asian stories that are consistently top 10. And obviously all the K-pop, K-beauty, like K-everything has been blowing up. Food and Bev, we've been getting so many great products. It's been really great to see that. I think some people may say, is the interest of the masses going to change one day? How do you think about that?
For me, the data seems actually relatively categorical. Just looking at this community, about 7 to 10% of the US population double over the next couple of decades. And more importantly, purchasing power of this demographic is already the highest among all racial groups and continuing to grow at the fastest rate. Why I'm particularly excited about what's going on in CPG is guided by what happens in pop culture. We're seeing different types of representation across TV, film, and music, where you're seeing Asian and Asian American voices all having success the volume and the magnitude of the success means that it really crossed over more into the mainstream. This is now all part of American culture. And that to me has been the goal and the hope when I set out about 5, 6 years ago. And I know other folks in our space as well, a lot of us built around the same time. Jing from Fly By Jing, the Kevin from Emmy. We all had this idea that we're not trying to just build in our own little Asian corner. Our brands are actually part of a bigger American trend.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the hope, right, with inclusivity and representation, is that what's maybe novel and feels like a trend to us is what eventually would just be normalized, right, as part of society, that we don't have to call these things out and say we have to celebrate them, especially because it's just so normal. I definitely think that we're getting there. Younger generations are already seeing that as more of a normalized thing.
I completely agree with both of your points. The ideal outcome of inclusivity is that it becomes so ingrained in our society that diversity isn't something we need to highlight specifically. It's simply the way things are. I also see that younger generations are already showing a shift towards that mindset. When you first launched Sanzo, you were the first Asian-inspired sparkling water brand. Did this first mover advantage help you establish brand recognition, or were there unexpected hurdles you encountered?
There can be a first mover advantage that can be quite helpful to a CPG brand trying to stake out a place, especially in what is already a relatively large category. Sparkling water is about a little over $5 billion in just pure retail sales. And so I think having a differentiated point of view on the category definitely was a bit of a tailwind. 5, 6 years ago, pretty much everyone who passed on us because their take was, is this Asian thing, is it too niche? Is this a brand or is this a trend that's really built just for Asians? Certainly at the time when I was getting a lot of these no's in the beginning, it would be a little disheartening, but I always try to take the best learning opportunity that I could out of them. And what it was, hey, go build a brand that can be both a taste of home for our community, but also a celebration and an exploration for folks who are not in the community. We always tried to take any downside that existed as our opportunity to kind of flip it on its head and actually make that a positive for us.
I love the positivity spirit you have. I'm just curious, has any of those either investors or distributors have come back and said, please give us a second chance or we were wrong?
Multiple. A number of these folks, they specifically invest in like the pre-seed, seed level. By the time they were interested in us, it was like, shoot, it's actually now outside of our mandate. We really can't invest anymore. I'll also say now being 5, 6 years in, I now have the benefit of folks sending me decks and getting to see how the other side of the table works. It's not an easy job. Nothing in this industry is. The way that I say it is, I don't think we could have gotten to where we are without the nose that we got along the way. And I'll say in particular, I won't say the name of the distributor, but it's one of our regional distributors. When we came on board, they have said to me many times after the fact that they didn't quite get it. They carried us because Whole Foods was excited to work with us, but especially in the earliest days, it really took our team putting in, and myself included, the work in at 4 or 5 a.m., getting the stores, working with their sales rep, working in store, working with different independent store owners, build up the brand. And fortunately, I think we're actually able to show within the first 6 months that no, like the brand actually does turn on its own. And this is a thing. Another lesson to me being a founder in this space where you have to go out and earn your stripes. You know, there's a lot of amazing brands that are out there, some of which for whatever reason come out of the gate coming out like super strong, some of whom are maybe later bloomers, but it's really on the brand, and I think especially on myself as a founder, to take responsibility and accountability for building the brand where you're at, really engaging in the hand-to-hand combat of building a beverage brand on the street.
That's very gracious of you. But it must have been a nice validation that you're like, yes, I knew it. I told you guys. You didn't believe me.
I'll say particularly beverage, it attracts masochists. And I guess I have to ascribe that to myself where there's almost like, okay, you're going to tell me it's a no, or you're going to tell me it's not going to work. I want to prove it out even more.
Having the benefit of hindsight and looking back on how you pitched either to investors or to distributors 5, 6 years ago, would you have changed your pitch in any way?
Good question. The best way I probably answer that for us, and it's a bit of a quarter degree turn, but I feel really glad that more people said no to us. It really forced us to stay hyper regionalized and localized, but every founder gets tempted. A large format retailer that you wouldn't have thought you would have gotten in year one, year two comes by and says, hey, we'll give you a shot, but you need to pay all this, but we'll give you 1,000 doors out of the gate. Fortunately, we never really got those opportunities because enough folks were skeptical about how far-reaching we could become. And so what I take from this as I look back is like, wow, I'm really, really glad that our build has been as regional and as methodical.
That's a great point and lesson for founders. Growing too fast is a pitfall that we hear about over and over from founders. We've had a number of founders on who said that making that decision to move too fast and going into a place like Walmart too soon was something that they regretted. Switching topics, in previous podcasts, you've talked about one of the reasons that you launched Sanzo was to bridge cultures. I'd be interested to hear more about your customer base and plans for growth.
People get surprised when I report some of our own customer demographic numbers. We currently have about 30 to 35% of our consumers from within the Asian American community, which if you look at U.S. Census data, is roughly three times the national average of about 7 to 10%. So as you would imagine, you know, we do over-index on the API community, but that also leaves another 55 to 70% of our consumer base that is actually coming from private community. Last year, we knew that in order to open up more doors, launch into different channels, we knew that the brand was going to have to start getting out of our identity as strictly a single-serve offering. So the beginning of last year, we launched a six-pack format, which our category data told us that close to 97% of all category sales are done in a multi-serve format. So if you look at specifically LaCroix in their 12-packs, you look at Spindrift in their 8-pack, that kind of guides what we saw in the real world, but we still didn't know what was going to happen for us. We're now about 9 months into that launch, and what we can see is that the velocities of the 6-pack are about 3x those of our single serves. We have a thesis that's rooted in a level of category data. We also appreciate that, hey, even if you have all this data, it may not necessarily pan out for your particular brand or your particular offering. Maybe consumers would have preferred that we were in a 4-pack or an 8-pack or a certain type of price point. But I have to be mindful, it actually took executing on a number of things internally to get to where we are. Even if we knew what the data was, to get from point A to point B, it still took execution on marketing, on sales, on operations to get that right.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's definitely an element of you don't know what you don't know. The importance is probably just staying really close to the data and what's actually happening to the business and how customers are perceiving things, and then just adapting, which sounds like you've done a great job of.
My take, I don't know if anyone else would have this take. Look, I also think part of it's luck. To your point about you don't know what you don't know, we want to make sure we're, to your point, always reacting to how consumers and customers are, but also acknowledge that sometimes you take your best shot and it hits or it doesn't hit.
Totally. And you keep trying, right? Until you get it. So, yeah. So Sanzo's flavors are really cool and fun, right? Calamansi and pomelo and yuzu. What's your inspiration for coming up with flavors?
I'll say there's a couple of thoughts here. One of which is, okay, what's generally popular within the flavor set that is native or indigenous to Asia? And how can we be a brand that creates a platform to celebrate these flavors? So as an example, you know, when I launched the brand, our first three flavors were calamansi, which if folks have never had it before, it's a Filipino golden lime that's a hybrid between a lime and a tangerine in one fruit. It is, again, Sandro's hot take. I think it's the best citrus fruit in the world. I think it's literally the perfect citrus because it has the perfect blend of tart and sweet in one. And then our second flavor was lychee. I particularly associate that with East Asian culture, although a lot of my South Asian friends are like, no, lychee is ours also. Our third flavor was Alfonso Mango, which is like liquid gold to folks in Indian communities. From the beginning, I always thought for Sanzo to be a celebration of the wonderful tapestry of sub-Asian cultures that make up almost half of the world's population. And that is the core tenet of what we are as a brand. We want to be a celebration of culture. But look, on the back end of it too, was to also demonstrate the relatability of these flavors, right? Like calamansi the fruit that I love from the Philippines. But if you didn't know what it was and you just sipped it, you would have a certain familiarity of it. You'd be able to identify certain notes that are like, oh, this tastes like a lime and a tangerine. When I think about bridging cultures, it's a way to show a level of distinctiveness, but ultimately with a backdrop of familiarity. When we're doing R&D, when we're thinking about how we launch a flavor in retail, we want the flavors and the actual formulation to meet that criteria.
Yeah, I've got a flavor pitch for you. It may be a really bad one.
Let's
or,
do it.
Or very good, maybe, as well. Durian flavored sparkling water. What do you think?
The truth be told, we've actually started playing around with some durian suppliers.
Oh, okay.
As you might imagine, our formulators, not too happy putting it together. If you pop open a can, aromatic can leave a little bit to be desired. But then once you taste it, it is delicious. We actually have videos of our team internally and a couple of other institutional investors trying out some live samples. It's polarizing.
That's amazing. If you ever do decide to launch full scale, I would love to try some. I think I'm actually on the side that doesn't like it so much, but I have so many friends that just love durian and that tastes like home to them, right? And so when you were talking about like the origin of that, I immediately thought of durian.
I will say this, and we've thought a lot about the storytelling too. It's like, if we were to launch it, we also know that there could be a temptation for someone to launch it and have more of like a tongue-in-cheek or joking attitude. Then maybe we would. Maybe we would to a certain degree. If we were to do it, we'd want to celebrate it. We want to do some storytelling around why this fruit is so important to certain cultures.
That's awesome. I hope you do end up launching it. Building on that, how do you balance the tension between telling that story authentically through flavors, yet appealing to a large and diverse customer base?
For us, there's really needed to be a massive trade-off. I think if anything, that's why we are pretty intentional about using the real fruit in the formulations. When I initially launched, my main thing was, okay, we're putting the real fruit in here because if someone doesn't like it, it's not because they don't like me, it's because they don't like the fruit. I'll say like our calamansi, it's like, well, that's on you because we're literally putting in the real fruit. And maybe this gets into like another driver for why I wanted to launch the brand. When I was seeing just how much Asian and Asian American culture was being celebrated in the US, I wanted a brand that authentically celebrated this. And to me, authenticity was using the real flavors. I would have hated, particularly as a Filipino, for someone to have an incorrect first impression of what a calamansi was because they maybe had terribly formulated version of what they like a calamansi natural flavor or artificial flavor. But I always say to folks, like, if you don't like it, like that's cool. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to give you the real fruit so that you at least know if you don't like it, that you're at least tasting the real thing.
I completely agree with your emphasis on using real fruit. It's a fantastic way to authentically deliver a high quality taste experience, and it's clearly resonating with your customers. What's been the biggest surprise for you on this journey? Something you absolutely didn't expect.
The biggest surprise for me in this journey, honestly, has been how capital intensive the beverage industry is. I don't have a co-founder, no business partner, and I launched it most of my life savings. And that proved to be a drop in the bucket for what is necessary to building and scaling a beverage brand. I'll say 2024, we're starting to really get some economies of scale. We're seeing now the benefits of that through the P&L, but it taking 4 or 5 years to get to this point, we really have to grind each bit of it out. Is I can't understate to aspiring entrepreneurs how much of a gauntlet it is in this industry to get to this point. Something we don't take for granted. And I don't say it as like trying to pat ourselves on the back. It's actually more of a cautionary tale to anyone who's aspiring to get into this industry of like, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you have enough conviction around what you're building? And does what you're building really have a true point of differentiation around it? Because being the 37th CBD beverage, that was a tough spot to be in. And now being the 37th version of other trends that are very in vogue right now, that's a tough spot to win, especially when you're dealing with retail shelves that do actually have finite space. And that's usually 1 4-foot shelf. You actually have to have either a point of differentiation, either in your formulation or in the way that you are marketing and branding your product. Having not come from a CPG background originally, I don't know that I appreciated just how high the barrier is It may have helped having set that level of naivete because I just had blinders on building what we're building and the way that we are.
Your point will resonate with a lot of founders within the beverage industry. As you mentioned, the costs go well beyond just the production. Founders have to factor in marketing, distribution, slotting fees. These add up to large dollar amounts. Many founders who lack a CPG background are often shocked by this. I always advise founders that the first question to a co-packer should be, what's your minimum order quantity? Because if they tell you it's 100,000 units, it's probably not the right co-packer for you. The financial risk is simply too great. Finding the right co-packer with manageable minimum order quantities is so crucial for early stage success.
Could not agree more. We got super lucky. We first worked with a micro canner in South Brooklyn, where fortunately the minimum order quantity was 3,000 per SKU. Nice. And the run was small enough that I was actually able to fit the entire run in my 500 square foot studio apartment. In a similar vein, when I talk to other founders, do the minimum quantity that allows you to prove out whether people want it or not. That first run doesn't even need to have great growth margin. You need to have a path to it, but mostly what you need to do in that first run is prove out whether someone even wants it.
You're right. Understanding the financial realities of the industry is crucial. But do you believe these high barriers to entry are actively stifling innovation and preventing exciting new brands from even getting started?
Loaded question. This business isn't fair. It's a business that requires capital. And so those who have access to capital or who can get access or can network to get access to capital are going to have, I would say, unfair advantages. And I say unfair because they may not necessarily be the most deserving. They may not be the best operators versus someone who may come from an underrepresented background who would be a phenomenal operator, but may not have the network. It's a tough one. If you still walk down an entire large format grocery store, I think there is still a ton of opportunity for underrepresented founders, specifically representing different cultures and whatnot, that have their product on shelf and become the next nine-figure brand. What I worry about is in an environment where access to capital has gotten a lot tighter, the reduced access to capital kind of widened the advantage for folks who come from certain networks versus those who do not. That needs to be ideally rectified, but also at a minimum, it's just that is the nature of this industry.
Yeah. In a previous podcast, you mentioned the idea of being a good ancestor. What does that mean to you, and how does that guide your decision making with Sanzo and what legacy you want to build with it?
Sure. So to provide context in the comment, in the broader discussion around being a first gen or even an immigrant, my parents immigrated, but I'm first gen. And so basically what headspace immigrants and first gen folks can occupy. And I'll say, at least for myself and a lot of other folks that I'm around, we talk so much about wanting to be good sons and daughters of our parents who made this massive sacrifice by immigrating halfway across the world. And so it gets into our head, sometimes from our parents, but also a lot of times from us, particularly this idea of we want to be great descendants. But someone from within our space gave me, honestly, probably one of the most earth-shattering aphorisms was this idea of changing your mentality from trying to be a great descendant to your parents to being a great ancestor for your kids and your grandkids. Mm. And that idea for me completely shifted a lot of how I view the world. And when I started viewing the world from that perspective, even when I started looking at my parents, my thought was they pissed off their parents by moving halfway across the world. But it's because they believed that coming to America was going to create more and better opportunities for then my two brothers. And then I was born in, after my parents moved to the US. It changed how I view my relationship with my parents. And it's now made me think a lot more differently about how I build this brand and how I talk to other immigrant and first-gen founders. I think what it ultimately belies is a difference between scarcity and wealth mentality. The idea of trying to get your piece of the pie versus building and expanding a bigger pie. And when I'm reflecting on this current journey that I have very much like the fortune to be on, it's that I'm building alongside a founder network that shares that same mentality. So a lot of those names that I mentioned before, we do share the same mentality around building a better future for us and for the next generation. And that's what gets me excited about the build.
Your point about the great ancestor mindset really resonates. As an immigrant, I have also struggled with the pressure to be a good descendant. But similarly to you, I find great sense of fulfillment and desire to create opportunities for others. Where do you think you can take the brand the next 5 to 10 years?
I believe Sando is the next global water brand. And when I say global water brand, the brand that we look up to in the space, we look at brands such as San Pellegrino, Perrier, more recently, Topo Chico. When we look back, you know, 5 years from now, we'll even give it 10 years from now. When we think of what is going to be the next big brand in this space that's driven by culture, in the 90s, I think what we thought of as aspirational cultures were the French Alps or the rolling hills of Tuscany. I think over the 2000s, there was a lot of Mexican and overall Latino culture that's just gotten really big. And you've seen that with the rise of the Latino community. I think we're at the beginning stages of that within the Asian and Asian American community, such that in 10 years, my hope is that it will seem kind of obvious that the next big global water brand will come from something that is Asian or Asian American inspired. But that's my ultimate vision for Sando. As we're talking about San Pellegrino, Perrier, and Topo Chico, hopefully someone in 10 years will literally say Sando in the same exact sentence, in the same exact breath.
We're getting to our final question here. What one piece of advice would you give to young aspiring founders, especially those from underrepresented backgrounds, who want to create businesses rooted in their own heritage?
Oh, boy. One piece of advice.
It could be multiple.
Man. The first goes back a bit to what we were talking about before. You do need to create something that honestly is potential to be large for anyone to put a good amount of money behind. We very much try to authentically take our inspiration from the communities that we represent, but we've always had to have an eye towards how this brand can sell to a variety of different consumers. And sometimes this industry may attract folks who just may not have either that academic background or professional background or whatever the case may be. So I think that's the first thing, is like a food and beverage company can start at the passion project, and that's how many of them start. And I think that's unbelievable. Mine actually was not too far off. Like, it was very much a manifestation of a personal journey. But once you actually want it to be a business, you need to have an empathy for the folks who may fund you, the people who are going to put your product on the shelf, the fact that they are picking your product, they're deciding between your product and someone else's. And so just having that level of empathy, I think, is massive. And then as part of that, you got to put in the work, you got to put in the reps. Unless you are directly working for or with a brand that's got a celebrity or a talent that's got 10 million or 100 million subscribers on YouTube or followers on TikTok, you got to build it from the ground up. In this industry, no substitute for doing something well inside a store.
Yeah, I love that. Sandro, thank you so much for coming on Consumer Rundown. We really appreciated sharing your story and being so open about Sando and your journey. I think it's really inspiring to the rest of us, not only in the greater API community, but just for founders who are trying to have their legacy and create new products. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you all for listening. Please subscribe for more episodes of the Consumer Rundown podcast and visit us at consumerrundown.com. See you next time.